William Cope Moyer's new memoir about addiction and recovery begins in 1994 when he walked out on his wife and two children and was getting high at a crack house in Atlanta's inner city. His father, the journalist Bill Moyers, had tracked him down and come to get him. It's not the only time in the memoir when William is rescued by his family. He wrote his memoir when he was 47 years old and 12 years sober. He's now vice president at the Hazelden Foundation in Minnesota, a drug and alcohol rehab center where he previously spent time in recovery. William Cope Moyers, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me about one of the times when your father came knocking on the door of a crack house looking for you.
Well, there are a couple stories in the book about that. One of them was in St. Paul, Minnesota, where I live now. I was relapsing, and he came to the apartment building where I was holed up. He and my wife and the building manager came into the apartment, and I hid in the closet from the very people who loved me and wanted to help me. And they reached into the closet and searched through the clothing and somehow missed me, and then they were gone. There was another time in Atlanta in 1994 when I finally took responsibility, my father didn't come to the door per se, but he was waiting in the van when I entered the van.
Why was crack your drug of choice?
It was the drug in the end, Terry, that worked. I had started experimenting with marijuana when I was a teenager growing up in the quiet suburbs of Long Island, and I progressed onto the legal use of alcohol and then into harder drugs like cocaine and other things. But after a while, those drugs sort of stopped working, and only in 1988, through an accidental encounter with a crack dealer on Long Island, did I smoke crack for the first time. It brought me to my knees, literally, as I recount in the book. It became my God with a small G. And it worked. I mean, it sort of filled that hole in the soul. It had a power over me that none of the other drugs had. I mean, and it worked to the point where it drove me not just down to my knees, but down to the hole of my addiction, so that in 1989, a year later, I hit bottom in a crack house in Harlem, New York.
In describing how your addiction affected your relationship with your family and affected your family's life, you reprint some of the letters that your father sent you over the years. And I'm going to ask you to read one of them. And this one's on page 64. I'm going to ask you, before you read this excerpt, to tell us when it was written and what the circumstances were.
Well, yes, this letter was written right after I had been arrested in December of 1980 as I was going back to college and as I was mulling over what I was going to do once I graduated in 81. So if you look on the previous page, he's having a frank conversation about the fact that I got some problems here, but he's wanting to let go of me and let me discover my own way in the second half of this letter.
So would you read it for us?
Okay. And so my father writes, "I think you were probably right in wanting, at least for a couple of years, to work on a newspaper. And I think that as much as I love having you around here, or close by, it's probably good for you to go off on your own. If you stay in this business, I believe there is a possibility that one day, in some capacity, we'll be collaborating on a project or two. But first you have to keep out of my reach. I can't stop being a father right now, and if you're around, I'll be giving you too much advice, asking you to take on my priorities, putting a safety net under you too often to allow you to make your own mistakes, and generally do the things a father's here to do. But as the old prayer goes, Lord, teach me to let go. And I can't let go as easily if you're in the house or next door. As hard as it will be on all of us to have you so far away, we'll be able to get together, we'll meet for long weekends and vacations, and we'll know all along that the purpose of the sacrifice now is for some important goal down the road."
What impact did this letter have on you?
Well, my father was, earlier in the letter, my father was sort of taking my inventory as to the realities that something, was troubling me inside. On the other hand, he was saying, son, you've got to grow up and you've got to move out from underneath me and get out there on your own and make your own successes and make your own mistakes. And don't worry, we'll be able to get back together one day. I think my father was being both hopeful and perhaps a bit nervous that something was not right with me, but that perhaps it would work itself out if I could just get out from underneath this man called Bill Moyers.
When you were in rehab, your father had to fill out a concerned person questionnaire, and you reprint something that he wrote in that, which is, "Intimacy has always been a problem for me, and I show emotions very little, partly because that is my nature, and partly for professional reasons, journalistic objectivity, that is." And in talking about how his journalistic orientation affected your relationship, you describe how once when you were actually talking with him, and as you describe it, spilling your guts about what was going on with you and your addiction, he actually took notes. He took notes on it, and then he sent you those notes years later to help you understand what you were going through at that time. I found that kind of amazing.
It is amazing, and I give my father credit for that, actually, because I think, you know, my father, when it comes to being a journalist, he's been objective over the years, but when it comes to the love he had for me as his oldest son, there's no such thing as objectivity. And yet he did have the presence of mind to write some of these things down, probably so that it would be the kind of record that both of us could look back on and remember, you know, without the emotion of the moment that always tends to sort of tilt the perspective one way or the other.
During for several years, even during some of the years of your addiction, you worked in journalism. You wrote for newspapers, you worked for CNN, and you did well. And you were even able to function during certain periods of addiction. In your book, you write that you liked deadlines, that deadlines were like drugs. They focused me. And I was wondering, did you like the adrenaline too? Did you find that adrenaline was a good drug for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a guy who likes thrills. I like excitement. I used to jump out of airplanes from time to time and go flying and do things like that. I don't do that anymore. I keep my feet on the ground. But I guess what I'm trying to say is, yes, for a long time, drugs worked. They did for me what I couldn't do for myself, which was to make me feel better, to sort of pick me up, to keep me up, to help me drive towards some sort of finish line. And for a while they worked. That's why I took them. But after a while they stopped working, and I still kept taking them. Even though they didn't work, I still needed them just to function, believe it or not. And for a long time, I really did live that Jekyll and Hyde a lifestyle where I could look good on the outside, and yet I was dying on the inside. I could be productive on the outside. Yet on the inside, I was struggling valiantly against a power greater than myself, in this case, the disease of addiction.
My guest is William Cope Moyers, and he's written a new memoir called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. And he was addicted to crack cocaine. What do you think was different about your fourth stay in rehab, the one that you emerged from without going back to crack?
I surrendered.
What does that mean?
I surrendered. It means I gave up trying to do it my way. And I think the most remarkable moment for me was waking up in the detox in October of 1994 and pondering this question, now what? And for the first time in my life, I didn't have an answer to now what. And it was that stunningly stark realization that I had run out of options, that I didn't have the answer to how I could get on top of this problem anymore. It was that stark realization that led me to say, I'm done. I don't have the answer. And if I don't listen to other people who have that answer, I'm going to die. And I was at a point in the fall of 94 when after this last relapse, I just gave up trying to do it my way. And I've been sober ever since.
After you got sober and stayed sober, you heard a voice that you interpreted as the voice of God speaking to you, saying the word St. Paul, as in St. Paul, Minnesota, which is near where Hazelden is, the rehab facility, which you had been in. And at the time you heard this voice, you were living in Atlanta, and you actually followed the voice and decided to move with your family to St. Paul, although you'd be leaving a job. You had no job options ahead of you in St. Paul. Had you ever had that kind of voice that you heard before? Had you ever had something that you'd interpret as a vision or a visitation?
No, I hadn't. And I think that's a good point you raise. There I was, devastated, in detox and in treatment in Atlanta, out of options, unable to answer the question, now what? And while I was there, I had this whisper in my ear, which was St. Paul. And in my own mind, I knew where that came from. It came from God. And I knew what God was telling me to do. You know, ironically, I didn't know the story of St. Paul the Saint. So I figured God couldn't be talking about that. He must have been talking about the city of St. Paul, Minnesota, where I'd spent some time during my early treatment experiences at Hazelden. And so we went back to Minnesota, Allison and I and the boys did, because I knew that if I was going to stay sober, I better do what other people tell me to do, whether they were counselors or whether it was God.
And so you moved back to St. Paul. You were looking for a job, and
yes,
eventually, like months later, you saw an ad in the newspaper that Hazelden, the rehab facility in which you had been in rehab, was looking for somebody who would be a public policy specialist. You applied for the job, you got the job, and suddenly you were working in your area, addiction, that was now your field.
Amazing.
Yeah,
and
you're working on public policy. It seems to me one of the things you realized when you started working in the area of public policy is how lucky you were that you had the money for rehab, which a lot of people don't. But did it change your views at all about the nature of how American culture deals with addiction once you started working on public policy issues?
Yes, because, you know, until that time, I'd always gotten access to treatment. I, like you noted, I did have resources. My family helped me. I had some money in the bank. I was able to work and make money, and so I had resources. And when I would go to treatment, I just sort of figured out that that's when you had a problem with alcohol and other drugs, that you got to go to treatment. But when I started working at Hazelden, I realized that I was the exception rather than the rule, that most people like me never get to treatment or get to treatment that's less than what they need to recover. I mean, I work for the Hazelden Foundation. We're a not-for-profit that's been in business, you know, helping people like me since 1949. And suddenly I was on the other side of the fence. I'd gone from being a patient there in the early 90s to being an employee who was working on the very issues that were all about access to treatment. And I realized right away that this country's public policy discriminated against people like me. And, you know, Hazelden thinks that's wrong. And that's why we've been doing public policy, and that's why I got hired to sort of try to change public policy, in part by changing public perceptions about addiction treatment and recovery.
President Bush used to have a drinking problem. I believe you've met him and talked about policy with him. Is that right?
I did, actually. In the May of 2001, when the world was a very different place before 9/11, I was in the Rose Garden. I'm not quite certain how I got invited there, but I was there. And that President Bush was introducing his nominee for drug czar, John Walters. And after it was over, the president was coming down the line shaking hands, and I stuck out my hand. I said, "Mr. President, my name is William Moyers. I'm from Minnesota, and I'm a person in recovery." That's all I said. And without batting an eye, the president shook my hand, and he said, "Sounds like we have something in common." Well, I was born in Texas, and the president wasn't, so we don't have that in common. I know who he voted for in the election of 2000, and so we don't have that in common. But what the president and I do have in common is that both of us have recovered from the desperate condition of too much drinking, or at least in my case, drugging, as well. And I think the president could relate to that. And I think this president actually sort of understands the power of recovery in a way that perhaps other presidents haven't. Now, understanding it and forging good public policy on it are two different things. But I do believe that the president does understand that that people can be ravaged by this problem and that you can recover from it. He recovers differently than I do, apparently. I had to go to treatment, and I guess he didn't. But the fact of the matter is that we've recovered from the desperate condition of too much drinking and drugging, and, you know, what happened to he and I should happen to lots of people.
Because President Bush had been a drinker early in his life, did you expect a different kind of policy to emerge from his White House?
Well, public policy in America is driven by public perception. And the public perception around addiction is a perception that is clouded in the stigma of addiction. I guess the fact of the matter is that personal belief alone cannot inform public policy, and that it's going to take a bipartisan approach before we begin to shift this war on drugs away from one that punishes the addict and the alcoholic to one that treats them while still holding them personally responsible.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
William Cope Moyer's new memoir is called Broken, My Story of Addiction and Redemption. He's a vice president at Hazelden, a drug and alcohol rehab facility in St. Paul, Minnesota.